Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Mattsson, your host and the editor of Self-Build Magazine.
So we have Mark Coleman, who featured in the spring 2021 edition of Self-Build Magazine as the home improvement project for the Republic of Ireland. So maybe, Mark, you could start with giving us some background to how the project actually started.
Hi, Astrid. Elaine and I, we were young. We're still young people, but we were younger a couple of years ago. We're in our mid-20s, living in Dublin, renting an apartment just in Stepside, kind of the south side of the city. And we'd been living there for a number of years. I suppose our work had brought us to Dublin. We're both professionals, I guess. And I suppose the first couple of years that we were there, we had a great time in and out of the city, restaurants, nightclubs, what have you. But then I suppose as the years went by, we would have got engaged and we were probably thinking more towards our future. I suppose what started to happen then was we were trying to save a bit of money for the wedding and for, a home. I suppose the other thing as well is that, like, I'm from Cork, if you couldn't tell from the accent, and Elaine is from Kerry, actually South Kerry, right down the very bottom. And so we kind of knew as well that Dublin was never going to be our home. It was always, it was just a means to an end at that time. But we always knew we were going to be heading back down south at some stage. So again, around that time, like, I would have had a very progressive boss at the time. He's since retired, but at the time, I would have kind of floated the idea to him about working remotely down in the south. And he was on for that. He was happy that at that time, this was back in 2016 when we moved. So great, I had that in my back pocket. And then I suppose the next thing then was to try and get Elaine a job in the south. And long story short, Elaine managed to get a job in Kerry. So perfect.
Of all places,
the kingdom, exactly. So we were delighted, of course. Given both of our jobs, we would have thought that Cork was probably the better or like the most likely place to get to get two jobs. But it turned out that Kerry was it. So it was great. We within a couple of months, we packed up and we were gone. And so that was it. So I suppose we moved to Kerry. We got married that year in 2016. And again, all that time we were, we were saving money, because I suppose the other thing as well is that Dublin, like we had an apartment, we moved into the apartment in 2012. At that time, the rent was $1,000 a month, which is pretty okay for where it was and what it was. But then every year that went past, the rent was going up €100 every year per month. So 2013, it was 1,100, 1,200, 1,300, 1,400. So it was €1,400 a month by the time we were getting out of Dublin. Subsequent to that, I went back on and I saw similar apartments in the same scheme, and they were going for €1,800 a month, you know, not too long afterwards, just because there was a big crunch on in Dublin. It still is there today. And I just, by way of comparison, like when we moved down to Kerry, we managed to get a farmhouse, a 3-bed farmhouse, for €400 a month. So, you know, we were saving €1,000 a month straight off on rent. And, you know, we had a big house, like, you know, with living rooms and, you know, bathrooms and kitchens and stuff. So that was a big help for us because, you know, even at that stage, we still didn't know exactly what we wanted, whether it was a new build or a kind of a renovation or whatever. But us getting out of Dublin at that time, you know, gave us that great opportunity to start saving up money, you know. So, so that was kind of it. We were in that farmhouse then for, I think, 2.5 years, roughly, I think. While we were there, then I guess like we were kind of keeping an eye on the market and kind of keeping our options open. There was, as it turns out, actually a couple hundred meters up the road, there was a ruin of you know, your traditional kind of farmhouse. You know, the door in the middle of the front of the building, and two windows either side, and then three windows above the top. And it was burnt out. You know, so it was literally just the bare shell. But it was on a gorgeous kind of hill. Views of Corrontool, views of the Pats, if anyone knows their mountains in Kerry. So like the place was just stunning. And anyway, we kind of put out the feelers and we managed to get talking to the owner of the land, and they were open to actually selling us the ruin with half an acre, because we knew that, like, I suppose we knew that, you know, I suppose, and no matter where you are in the Republic, I'm not so sure what the story is up in Northern Ireland, but definitely in the Republic, it can be tricky to try and get planning in a greenfield site. Particularly so in Kerry, you have to tie to agriculture, which neither of us had. And the only way really you can get planning for a new building in Kerry is if you're taking an old building, be it a ruin or something like that, and you're kind of, you know, doing an extension or rejigging it. So we put the feelers out to, I actually happen to, one of my friends here in town is quite friendly with, he's an architect, and he's put, just, I suppose, through his work, he's have good contacts with the council, and he just puts feelers out to see, you know, would we get planning, you know, us being two people from outside the county, although living in the area, but not, you know, we don't major connection to the area, I guess. And, you know, the word came back that, like, yeah, if we were to put in a planning application, things would be good. So we kind of progressed discussions with the owners, and ultimately they came back saying, well, actually, you know, before we sell you the ruin and the site, we actually want to kind of guarantee planning for ourselves first in the field next door. So would you be willing to hang around till we go for that planning? And we were sort of saying, oh, well, maybe, like, you know, but then we were sort of saying, like, you know, how long is that going to take? How long is it going to take them to go for planning? Will they get planning? If they get planning for a certain type of building, would that dictate what our building has to look like? And there was just all these sorts of things. And then we were sort of saying, well, part of the reason why this particular site was so nice is because it's kind of out in its own and it had unobstructed views of mountains and different, you know, north and south, or west and south. And, you know, if they plonk their house right in the middle, that's just going to take from it. So we thought about it for a while and we said, look, no, it's not for us. So I suppose that was that dead in the water. Like, you know, that was the only option really for us that we saw about a kind of a new build, let's say. And then I suppose, you know, if we were just keeping an eye on the, you know, the estate agent windows and the websites, and we came across the site or the house that we actually ended up buying. And it happened to be actually it happened to be for sale for a good few months. And I don't know why other people didn't kind of jump at it. Like, I mean, but when we actually properly looked at it and went for a viewing, we absolutely, you know, dove in. Like, we went sale agreed within a day or two. But I think probably what kind of put people off was, you know, probably aesthetically from the outside, it didn't look the best. Like, you know, it was a, you know, your typical bungalow bliss, you know, a brick built bungalow. The bricks were yellow as well, which probably didn't look great. The house definitely needed work on the inside. It was, you know, you big single pane windows, you know, it was just tired, you know, on the inside. It was built in the 70s and it just had never been kind of updated since then. And I suppose the other thing as well is that there was actually 2 acres came with the property. So that might have put a lot of people off as well. That, like, you know, you just had this massive kind of unwieldy garden. So we just said, look, let's give it a shout. Let's have a, you know, because we had gone and looked at a couple of other houses that just didn't work out. And we were kind of exasperated one night, and we kind of saw this on the internet, and we said, look, let's go and have a look. And I can still sort of remember Elaine's face when the auctioneer brought us in the front door, and you kind of, you walk down the hall a little bit, and you come into the living room, and there's kind of that big window. If anyone's referring to the magazine, it's the window where the rocking chair is now. You know, that just gives you like, this, you know, you're looking juice out, right out on the mountains of Clarny. And we were just like blown away. We just looked at each other and the two of us, you know, just that kind of, you know, that sort of hidden language that, that couples have between each other sort of thing. We just looked at each other and we just knew straight away, ah, this is it, you know. So we just spent the rest of the half an hour looking around the other parts of the building. And of course, we played it down with the auctioneer. We sort of said, oh, you know, this has needed a lot of work and, you know, this, that and the other. But ultimately, in the back of our heads, we knew that, look, this was it sort of thing. So yeah, as I said, we went to Sellagreed then. Sellagreed within a day or two, like, you know, we were kind of keen. I got pretty anxious that I didn't want anyone coming in, getting like someone like me or someone like us coming in saying, oh, geez, this would be a great renovation, you know. But no, thankfully we managed to seal the deal and yeah, it was ours, or at least it was, you know, Sellagreed anyway, yeah.
Yeah, very good. So then there was a bit of a lag between the time you actually were Sellagreed to the time you got the keys. So you had a bit of time to do the design, like go to the house and measure everything. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, I guess in a way that was kind of a bit of a blessing in disguise because so just to give you timelines, like we went Sellagreed on the 1st of March. And, you know, I guess we were expecting to maybe, you know, get the keys, you know, 6 weeks or 8 weeks later, but it actually turned out that we didn't get the keys. They didn't go through till August. So that was, you know, 5 months later. Cause in that 5 months, the previous owners wanted to retain a laneway at the side of the property. There was just issues with the boundary. The boundary wasn't exact and they had to go back in for planning a couple of times and there was a bit of back and forth, but ultimately, you know, it was at the end of the day, it was straightforward enough, but it just needed, the boundaries needed to be right. But that just meant that there was a 5 month delay. And of course, that meant that, like, we knew we were taking on a renovation. And we were just seeing, you know, the long, lovely, bright, sunny days of April, March, May, June, July, August, all the guts of August, all going by. So that was a bit of a bummer. But I suppose the other thing that gave us then was that because we'd gone Sellagreed, we were able to get the keys of the house to, you know, just on occasion to go up and take measurements and get a kind of a, you know, spend some time in the house, even though it wasn't ours, but we were able to spend time there, you know, to see, you know, what the sunlight was like and, you know, what the environment was like, you know. But the main thing is that we were able to take the measurements. We were able to get the measurements of the window openings. We were able to get the measurements of the rooms. So I suppose what I would have done then with all that sort of information is I would have taken that home. I would have used this online software called SketchUp. I don't know if anyone's heard of that before, but it's a brilliant piece of software. I think it's been subsequently bought out by Google. But it's just a free online software. You can go in, you can draw up anything. You can draw furniture, you can draw cars. And in our instance, I was putting in all those measurements to make a little model, a little 3D model of the house. So what I would have done is I would have just, built a model of the exterior walls and obviously the interior walls as they were. But I knew that the interior walls were stud partitions, so I knew that they could be moved if we felt that some of the rooms needed to be rejigged a bit. But that 3D model just really helped us visualize the building, you know, when we weren't there. So, I mean, like we could, you know, take measurements of the furniture that we had already, say, for example, and we could drop them into the model. We could move it around. You know, even with the models, well, you can kind of do a first person view, you can drop in and you kind of walk around the building. So I don't know, like you never need to see the software to kind of to really get it. But that was like a top tip because, you know, it just meant that we could really play around with the house. Like, I mean, just to give you an example, like we knew we were going to be changing the windows, but we didn't know exactly, you know, do you just go for those sort of picture windows where it's stuffed glass, or do you, you know, do you have a casement opening, how big should that casement opening be, you know? So we were able to play around with all of that to make, you know, and what would that window look like when you're standing out in the road, for example, or what color window frame should you go for, all those sorts of things. You could play around with it in that model. So like for us, that was a real you know, top tip or help to us, like, you know. So what that meant then is that, you know, the day that we got the keys, when the things finally went through, it meant that we were able to hit the road running, because we knew exactly where we were going to be, you know, what walls we were going to knock, what walls we were going to build, you know, because we did all mapped out, because we already had the window openings and the sizes and all that sort of stuff agreed. We already had prices in for the windows and all that sort of stuff. So that allowed us a lot more time to just really get our ducks in a row, you know, so that once we finally did get the keys, we could just hit the road running, you know. So
absolutely. So then how did you go about sourcing the windows and that and the window design? What was that process like then? You used SketchUp, but what was the next step after you decided? Because I guess you might have been restricted by what windows are on the market.
Well, I suppose what I would have done here around that time as well, Astra, there was the self-build, the live exhibitions. Back in the days when you can go out and meet people and whatever, but like the Mill Street Exhibition Centre isn't too far from where we are here. So that happened to be on that summer or that springtime or whatever. So like I'd gone to that and sure, of course I was pressing everyone for every bit of information I could get. But you know, there was a number of window companies there with their examples or whatever. So I guess from that and from, you know, reading the magazine, from watching, you know, shows on TV and whatnot, like you'd have a fair idea as to who the kind of manufacturers are. So I suppose like how we took our project forward was that we knew what our window openings were. We knew, you know, some of the window openings we were going to make a little bit bigger and some openings we were going to make a little bit smaller. But ultimately we had all of our sizes. So we were able to go just by email. We were able to email a number of the window suppliers and say, listen, I have a renovation project. I have 10 or 15 or 10 or 12 windows or whatever it is. These are the sizes. What's your best price sort of thing? And we got the prices back. We got three prices back. And we kind of, you know, obviously a cheap one, a middle one and a more expensive one. And, we were kind of thinking about like which of the ones would we go for? Like, I mean, the more expensive one, which is the one that we actually did ultimately go with Rationale. They were more expensive, but it's all relative. Like, I mean, you know, like they might have been like 10% more expensive than the next guy down the line. But for example, like, you know, we went to the lowest window guy, we kind of discounted him. So it was really between Rationale and the other company. And like, we knew from Rationale that, you know, from the self-build exhibition that, like, you know, the windows are, they're rock solid. Like, you hold onto the handle and you open it and it's really positive. There's, you know, it's not, you know, it's good and sturdy, like, you know, whereas they put it, the other manufacturer, like I happened to go to their showroom and, you know, I was looking at the window and I say, for example, the handle was actually loose. Like the handle was actually, you know, rattling in my hand as I was opening the window. And then like even the cut joints, that particular window that we got priced was a PVC, a UPVC window and frame, you know, in the upper corner where the 45 degree angle would be for the two pieces coming together, you know, the joint wasn't exact, you know, so like, and it was kind of filled in with a bit of kind of putty or something. And I was just sort of saying, geez, like if I'm paying, you know, the prices that we got from them was 16 grand or something. I was sort of saying, geez, if I'm paying 16 grand, I can't be dealing with loose handles and this sort of stuff. Like, you know, so just, we just sort of said, look, we just go with the slightly more expensive one. So, but like we've absolutely no regrets. I mean, they're absolutely bulletproof. I'm pretty sure they're probably the same windows they have in the White House, you know.
So then you also, so you had a garage to the side and converted that door into a window and kind of changed the layout inside as well. So was there any planning requirements for all of that, or was it just exempt because it was just fairly minor stuff, I suppose?
Yeah, it's relatively minor. You're not changing the, like I'd spoken to that architect, that my friend, and he was saying, look, no, it's fine. You're not changing the, and even if you do a Google online, you'll see that that garage conversions are all okay. Like, you know, I think you really need, like, if you're making massive changes to the front of your building, you probably would need to go for planning for that. But in this instance, no, we just, there was that garage door, is kind of one of those up and over old style aluminium doors. We just took it out. I mean, like, you know, the garage, you know, you couldn't even get a car into it anyway. Like, you might have been able to get a classic Mini into it back in the 70s, but these days, you know, the garage wasn't used for anything, and it was no use to us, especially when it was already underneath the, it was underneath the roof of the building. So to me, it was kind of wasted kind of potential. You know, you could easily build a garage off the side or down the back of the house, totally separate to the building. So for us, we just saw it as an extra, I don't know how many square meters it is, 16 square meters or something. So yeah, we took out the garage door, we built up a bit of block work, put in a window, same size as the bathroom window to kind of make it look, you know, to kind of streamline it. And yeah, that garage turned into being half of the garage became our utility, and the other half became the kitchen. So the kitchen was out at the, our new kitchen is at the south of the property. So again, we just wanted to make sure, that we got the, you know, those living areas were at south, the southern half of the house. But like for us, you know, it was a nice kind of win. Like, I mean, you know, as I said, we got that extra 16 or 20 square meters for nothing. We there was also, you can see the thing is that the previous owners would have used the garage as maybe storage for whatever. So the attic space was never used for anything. There wasn't even a kind of a stairway that you can pull down, you know, one of those stairs or stairs. There wasn't even one of them in the house. So that meant that, you know, it's very important obviously to have storage within the house for, you know, baby's clothes and whatever, golf clothes or whatever you're having. So, you know, having the attic space upstairs, I just shelved it out with old doors and old bits and bobs that we took from the house, you know, that all became storage and shelving in the attic, you know. So
very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then how'd you go about actually doing the work? You did a lot yourself, but what was the network you had around you? How did you, 'cause there's a bit of direct labor, a bit of friends and family. There's a bit of everything.
A bit of everything after it. Yeah. So I guess like when we started off, I guess we would have probably have been going down the line of maybe getting some local builder in to get the work. To do the work, because we knew, look, it was a full gut job, but did need a full replumb, a full rewire, and there was some, you know, building work, be it block work and also, you know, stud partitioning. Now, as it turns out, Elaine's dad is a carpenter. Like, I would have always known him as a carpenter. Like, you know, I would have known him for 10 years at that stage, and, you know, we would have been, myself and Elaine were married and all. So, but I would have only known him as being a, you know, I wouldn't have known him professionally, you know, like obviously he's the father-in-law, but I only always thought him as being a carpenter. But sure, as it turns out, sure, he's more a builder, you know, and carpenter and kind of, you know, jack of all trades, if, you know, for want of a better term, like, you know, he's well able to do all the sort of work. And, I suppose like the thing was that like where we're living now is still like, whilst we're in Kerry, we're still an hour from where Elaine is from. So it's not as if, you know, Elaine's dad was just around the corner to come over and do a bit of work, like, you know. So I suppose early on in the project, Elaine's dad offered to say, look, you know, because we kind of talked to him about what our plans were, and he said, look, I'll give you a hand there if you want. So we weren't expecting that, you know, but of course, yeah, look, take everything you can get. So I think, like, for me, like, I mean, I'd never laid a block in my life. I'd no real building experience. So I guess for me, I was just really kind of learning from Jerry. Like, I mean, Jerry would come up and, you know, we might maybe, you know, take out one of the windows, for example, put in new windowsills, all this sort of stuff. So, you know, I would have just been learning for him. So, like, say, for example, on the windowsills, just as one example, like, you know, we would have replaced the first five. I would have done the first five windowsills with him. But I did the other five myself, staying with my own brothers or with someone else that was helping, you know. So, and it was just like that over and over, you know. You know, doing block work as well, you know, once you kind of see how it's done and you know what the process is, you know, you can kind of learn on the job, like, you know, because I suppose I was keen to make the most of the time that I had with him. I knew that, you know, for him it was an hour up, you know, working for the day, and he had to drive home again in the evening because he had his own, you know, family to look after. So I was keen to, you know, when I'm getting him up, I'm getting him to do the very kind of specialist work that I couldn't do, you know, and any job that he was doing that I could learn from it, I'd make sure I would learn from it to be able to do it myself. So that way I just really made sure I got the absolute best kind of out of him, if you know what I mean. But of course, for me then, that means I'm learning on the job as well, which was great. Yeah.
Yeah, very lucky to have that. Yeah. So then heating and hot water, that's one of your bugbears, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess, I work as an engineer in the energy industry. So I guess this is something that was really kind of close to heart and something that I could really kind of put my skills to sort of, you know. So like, I suppose the background here is that like we would have been living in that farmhouse. Whilst it was, you know, cheap to rent, it was, you know, that there was no real heating system in the, there was no central heating, or the central heating system that was in it wasn't effective really. It was an oil boiler. It wasn't, you know, the rads weren't all that great. That meant that we were, you know, there was a solid fuel stove in the living room that we were feeding, you know, turf and coal and timber. And of course that had to be cleaned out every day, and, you know, more coal had to be bought and all this sort of stuff. So after the 2 years or the 3 years that we were there, we were just kind of tired of, you know, all of this, you know, all this, on the fuel side of things. And on the oil side of things, we were pretty sick of the smell of oil in the utility room from the boiler. So, you know, it's just a dirty sort of fuel. So we knew straight off the bat that oil and solid fuel were kind of out. And I suppose this was back in 2017 when we were doing the build or the renovation. So at that time, like heat pumps, and I suppose even still now, heat pumps were the sort of the up and coming technology, or the things that people, the technology or the fuel source that were being kind of pushed on people or whatever, or pushed by, say the likes of SEAI or whoever. And, but I had no experience of a heat pump. But, you know, from going to the self builds, exhibitions, and from doing my own kind of analysis online and research, you know, there's a couple of things I guess, you know, I kind of learned from, you know, what the sort of requirements you'd need for a heat pump. You know, I suppose the first thing that, you know, I would have kind of found out was that, like, it was difficult to get kind of unbiased advice. You know, if you were talking to the manufacturers, they're going to be quoting you, you know, great coefficients of performance for heat pumps. So, you know, they're really efficient is what you'd be hearing. And, you know, that they're green and all this sort of stuff. But I also knew that for a heat pump to be efficient, you know, your house has to be, you know, you have to remove all the air leaks from your house. So what that means is that, you know, if you're plasterboarding, you need to tape up between all the sheets of plasterboard. You need to tape around all the windows. You need to tape around anywhere where an electrical wire is going out through the wall. And, you know, I just sort of said, geez, like that's kind of, there's a lot of work involved in that. And then, you know, once you do all that work, you don't have to do an air tightness test. And if you fail it, you know, you have to go, you know, you might have to go back and do some remedial work. And I just thought that this was all kind of like,
yeah, because was the grant in at that stage, the heat pump grant? Because you do need to have a certain level of air tightness to avail of the grant.
You do, yeah. So like at that time, actually, they were doing SEAI were doing the pilot. The pilot scheme, I can't remember the name of it, but this is something that kind of bugged me at the time, is that the only way you could avail of that scheme where they would pay for half of the renovation work was if you buddied up with a couple of other renovators in your area so that you could kind of get an economy of scale with the deep retrofit scheme, yeah, or the pilot scheme. But yeah. Sure, I didn't know anyone else in my area doing a retrofit. So there was just kind of a lot of things outstanding about it. And then from speaking to a number of the manufacturers at the shows, you know, I was kind of asking them, well, look, how much are you talking for one of these things? And they were sort of saying, look, it's a five-figure sum, like by the time you have it bought and installed. And then, of course, the other side of things is that, you know, if you're taping up all your house, yeah, great, you're removing all of the air leakages, but you're not allowing any air in either. So you know, and you need fresh air for breathing. So then you're having to put in a mechanical ventilation system. So again, there's a cost to that. And like, you know, just like, as it just happens, around that time as well, my cousin was actually he was building a new build house, similar size to my own. And like, he'd been quoted €20,000 to do a heat pump, to plumb his house and to put in the mechanical ventilation. Whereas, like, say, for example, like the quote for me, or the price that I paid to do my full replumb and my boiler install was €6,000. So, like, so that's a big difference in your upfront costs. And I suppose, like, I haven't spoken to him since the, you know, we're both now in the house 2 years. like my cost in per year for my gas usage at the moment is coming in at $1,250 a year, and $250 of that is for hot water. Now at the moment the carbon tax I think is 30 or 40 euros a ton for CO2, so like in a couple of years that usage, that same usage is going to cost me 1400 euros a year for gas, for LPG. And that usage is based on having our living room at 21 degrees and having the, or bathroom at 20 degrees. Now, so 6,000 upfront and 1,400 a year, for example, right? And my cousin, as I said, he paid 20 upfront. Now his electricity usage is just over 4,000 kilowatt hours, and that's coming out at 700 euros a year. So it's half the price per year to run than my system, but it's cost over three times, to install the system. And when you actually, you know, when you put that into Excel and just kind of model it out over time, to see like what's your return on investment, or how much is it going to break even with a kind of a conventional system, it actually takes 20 years for the heat pump installation to match to the same amount of, you know, it's going to take 20 years for the two systems to cost the same amount, like, you know, but in that 20 years you're probably going to have to go in and replace your heat pump. Now you're probably going to have to replace your gas boiler too, but you're back to that same thing again, where you're having to, you know, just the heat pump insulation is a lot more than the LPG insulation, you know.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And in a retrofit, I suppose there's a new law that came in that didn't apply to you at the time, though. It came in a couple of years ago, where you do have to upgrade your whole house to B2. What's the energy rating you got at the end of your renovation, if you do a major renovation?
So at the moment we're B2 on paper, or officially we're okay. B2, but actually if you look at the so for my LPG usage, for the amount of liters of LPG I have, it works out at 10,500 kilowatt hours, and then my electricity usage is just under 1,500 kilowatt hours, so in total that's 12,000 kilowatt hours. And when you divide that by my house square footage or square meters, it comes in under 100, it comes in around 86 kilowatts per meter squared. And basically that means that will be a B1 house. That's pretty good. Like, you know, but I think like, I think the, like why, I suppose another reason why we wouldn't have gone for the heat pump is that, when you're looking at any heating system or hot water, well, you have to look at heating system, your central heating system and your hot water. On the hot water side of things, for example, again, at that time, you know, there was talks about these thermodynamic panels that were available, and, you know, the marketing around them was like, oh, look, you know, you get free heat in the sun and this, that, and the other. And I suppose when I actually looked at the kind of technical specifications of it then and the cost, like, you know, after the grant, like there was a grant at the time, I'm pretty sure the grant is probably still there. Like the unit was costing 5,000, but it was costing you 3,500 after the grant. And then, you know, the compressor in the panels had to be on for 7 hours a day, to keep the tank of water hot. And when you work out that usage for 7 hours a day over the whole year, it's going to be costing you 160 euros a year, 170 euros a year to just run that to give you, okay, great, you have a full tank of hot water. But if I just compare that just against a normal conventional, you know, your normal copper cylinder, like you can buy those for €300. And okay, your electricity use might be higher. Say, for example, if you've 3 kilowatt immersion on for 2 hours a day, that's going to cost you €365 a year. So like comparing those two things alone, it takes 15 years for the two to break even, or for the thermodynamic panel to break even with your conventional system. But maybe in that 15 years, maybe this new technology has faltered or whatever, like, you know. So, and then, you know, just in that brief example, that's assuming that you're using electricity to heat your hot water in the cylinder, as opposed to maybe what in reality people are using their, you know, their gas or whatever their central heating system is probably heating the hot water for them. So, you know, I just think that you just need to kind of look at some of these, you know, some of these technologies. You need to just kind of step back and just look at, like, how much actual power is it actually using? How much is it going to cost me? You know, and like our system, as I said, because again, I'm only speaking from someone who's done a renovation. So I wasn't subject to, you know, the sort of requirements that you need these days in relation to a new build. But for me, as someone who was looking at, who inherited a house, well, I didn't inherit, I had to buy it, but I had a house which had an old oil boiler, so I knew that was going to be replaced. So I knew I was going to be putting in a new boiler of some sort. And like the combi boiler, for example, gives you hot water on demand, so you don't need a hot water tank. And it costs me €250 a year. So I mean, like, that's even cheaper than your normal cylinder that you might have in your hot press, like, you know. So I just think people just kind of need to, and I don't know, like, maybe I can follow up with some kind of examples, just kind of plot it out, because maybe it's kind of hard to kind of get this over a phone call or over a podcast, you know, to show how these things can cost with time, you know. Because like the big thing, I suppose, like, where all this is coming from is that when we first like bought the house, we had to put a lot of money up front in with the deposit to actually buy the house. So that meant that actually we had a big deposit saved, we thought that we were going to have, you know, no issues with cash flow. But then actually when it came to it, we actually did have issues with cash flow. So that just meant that we really had to question everything that was being put into the house, you know, be it insulation, you know, be it the heating system on hot water, you know. We really just had to question, okay, can we afford to spend this €3,000 on such and such a thing, €8,000 on external insulation, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose that's just the background, you know?
Yeah. And it is a question of working out for your square footage, the regs, as you say, you do have to be regs compliant, and and doing all the calculations. It is a job unto itself to do all that. It's, mm-hmm. it's well worth doing, as you say. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then in terms of other tips, in terms of the redesign of the house, of how you kind of knocked down those walls and how you reconfigured the living space.
So like the wall that was between the garage, the old garage, and the rest of the house, that was a block wall. But I knew from going when I got Jerry and the father-in-law up at one stage, and we just double checked that, you know, the roof wasn't resting on the block wall, excuse me, in the attic. And it wasn't. So that meant that we knew that we could easily take down that block wall without causing any structural damage. So that was literally just me with a sledgehammer and a can goes one evening or a couple of evenings taking that down. In relation to the stud work, look, anyone who's done any bit of woodwork in school is able to put together, stud partitions, you know. So, and I suppose going back to the modeling, we knew how much space we wanted in each of the rooms. We tried to kind of keep the walls in place as much as possible, like, you know, but there was a couple of walls that we did move, most notably kind of around the ensuite and the wardrobe in the main bedroom. But that's relatively straightforward, you know, still partitioning. And then after that, you know, you're putting sheets of plasterboard up. So, I mean, again, just call in the troops, call in your brothers and your friends and your cousins just to give a hand with putting up the plasterboard. Because I think like the kind of one tip with a kind of renovation like this is that that I would give to people is, like, the more work that you can do yourself, notwithstanding, look, you know, we've two kids now, and, you know, I can appreciate things are time can be tight, but, you know, any bit of work that you can do yourself is going to save you money. It's going to, like, because otherwise you're paying someone 20, 30, 40, 50 euros an hour to do that work for you. If it's taking down a wall that you know can be taken down, like, obviously you need to get advice. But any of that laboring sort of stuff, you know, if you can do it yourself, that's going to save you money, you know. If you can build the sub partitions yourself and do the plasterboarding yourself, perfect. You know, that's less work that you're paying for the plasterer to do, for example. So, you know, it's those sorts of things, like, you know, going back to the, you know, you touched on it there earlier on in the chat, Astrid, about, you know, going direct labor, you know, the pros and cons about that. Like, I suppose, like, you know, if you were to, you know, go to a builder to say, listen, I want to do a whole renovation, I want it all plumbed, I want it all rewired, and I want all this, that, and the other, like, the builder is going to look at that and say, well, look, okay, like, he or she can, you know, they'll know what work is involved. They'll price up for all the materials for that. They'll price in their profit, which is due to them, like, let's be fair. But they're also going to build in, like, you know, a bit for risk, just in case they, you know, this takes them an extra week longer than they had thought or whatever. And they're putting that in at the front because, you know, you haven't even started the project. You haven't opened up things to show them what's in this house. So they're just going to factor that into the price that they give you. They're going to make sure that they're not going to get stung at the end of it. So if you're going direct labor, like me, for example, like, I would have got the electricians into price for the job when we had all the new partitions up, for example. And we knew, like, from the modeling, we knew exactly where all the plugs were going to be. We knew where all the sockets were going to be. So it was totally, there was nothing hidden for an electrician coming into us. We were able to say, look, we want 50 sockets and we want, you know, whatever it is. You know, for them, it's straight up to quote for them. Like, you know, there's no surprises on either side. So if you do that for the plasterer, if you do that for your electrician, and whoever else, you know, that's ultimately going to be saving you. And then again, like with the electrician, for example, you know, I did all the chasing in the external walls for the electrical wires and stuff. So again, that just saved him paying an apprentice or whatever for, you know, a couple of days doing that. I was able to just do that myself. So that just cut out work that you're paying a professional to do, you know.
Any other cost control tips like that, or how did you keep on top of costs? If there's...
Yeah, well, as I said, the big thing for us was cash flow. And look, I think anyone who watches Grand Designs or any of those shows is always cash flow. But I guess for us, we would have, I would have tried to do as much work as I could. I would have tried to, we would have set up accounts with the local DIY merchants, you know, to get better prices for, you know, all the wood that we needed and all everything else. So I suppose I would have been just constantly, like, looking ahead a couple of weeks. Okay, what jobs are coming down the line? Like, I mean, like, the first thing we would have done is ordered up the windows because we knew that was going to take 2 months to come through. So, you know, for that, I needed to make sure, okay, I need my window sills and I need my block work done ahead of that. And, you know, you're just kind of, you kind of build up a plan of, like, each week by week, what jobs need to be complete so that the next job can start, you know? And say, for example, like, again, going back to the direct labor side of things, like, I mean, one thing that any renovator might say, or anyone that goes direct labor, is, you know, it can be maybe an issue to try and get the professionals on site to do the work, you know, that you could be beholden to them a bit. But I suppose what I would have done is I would have known from my kind of program, and it wasn't like a professional program or anything, it was just kind of maybe on paper, like, or maybe in my head about, okay, I need to get this done the next couple of weeks. But say, for example, I might know that, okay, I need to get the electrician in to do the first fix in 2 weeks' time. I'd ring him up and I'd say, listen, I really need you next week, for example, I need you next Monday. And he'd come back and say, no, I can't do next Monday. And I'd say, okay, well, what about the week after? And he's like, yeah, I'll get you that week after. So I was getting what I wanted anyway, but, you know, I was kind of putting up this kind of facade that I was under pressure, this, that, and the other. So those sorts of things, you know, help you, you know, keep on track, I guess, like, you know. And like, it was like, don't get me wrong, I mean, like, we were living kind of paycheck to paycheck at the time. Like, you know, as soon as money was coming in, you were buying stuff. Money was going out on direct debits and stuff to the builders merchant. So, don't know if that answers your question, but.
Yeah. No, definitely. And you didn't insulate, did you, in the end, the external walls or?
Well, what we did is so again, like, these calculations are freely available off the internet. If you look for a U value for a wall, for example, you know, there's conductivity values for each sort of material, for blockwork, for insulation, for whatever it is. And, you know, once you know what your measurements are, once you know how thick your wall is or the different pieces of material are, you can put that into a calculation and work out what your U value is. So I knew starting off our U value for the walls was 1.75, which is pretty bad for, like, for a wall. And I knew from if I was to inject the walls with these little kind of polystyrene beads, if I was to pump the walls with those, it would bring the U value down to 0.45. So that's a big drop from 1.75. And I knew from having gotten the quote from the installation company that after the grant, that would only cost me €320. But I got the bargain for a massive drop in U value. And from the same company, then I asked them, okay, well, how much is it if I was to do an external insulation on top of that? Because insulation, you have to pump the walls anyway. And the quote that came back was 8,000 after the grant. I think there was a €5,000 grant available at that time anyway. And that would have brought the external insulation the U value from 0.45 down to 0.21. So, like, yeah, you're going the right direction, but, like, you know, you're having to pay €8,000 for that 0.2 difference, whereas I only paid €300 for the 1.3 difference in U value. So I just kind of felt that, you know, you're kind of getting into this thing of, like, diminishing returns. Like, you know, I suppose that gets back to the overall thing of this project was, look, we're trying to get us, we want to go in the right direction of getting our house energy efficient, and we're going to go as far as we can go, as far as the money will take us, but we're not going to be going, you know, we're not going to be, you know, extending ourselves money wise or whatever to give us something that we mightn't, you know. Is there going to be a big difference in the walls going from 0.45 to 0.21? It was hard to know, you know, and we're in the house, you know, 2 years now, and it's certainly a warm house. If we had the external insulation, would it be warmer? Yeah, for sure. But, you know, what's that going to relate to in costs of reduced gas, for example? That's hard to sort of to quantify, like, you know. And where we left it with the external insulation is that we said, look, we get into the house, and maybe down the line, once the cash flow and we have a bit of money saved up, maybe we'll do the external insulation at that stage, because, like, there is, like, the soffit on the house, there's a good foot and a half of soffit all the way around the house, so there actually is the space to kind of retrofit that external insulation on. So that is something that we might do down the line, but it's not on my radar at all at the moment, because the house is lovely and warm. I'm here now in my shirt, t-shirt, and, like, it's blown beast from the east outside. So, you know, I don't know if I could justify spending the 8,000 to maybe save €100 a year in my gas bill. You know, that it just doesn't equate in my head, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, were there any splurges?
Not really. I think the only splurge really were the windows, just because, like, that extra 10% was a couple of grand sort of thing. So that probably was, like, the biggest splurge, if you think of it from a money point of view. Like a lot of the stuff in the house, like, you know, is all, like, it didn't cost big money. Like, I mean, like the kitchen, you know, was under €8,000, for example, like, you know, and it's a gorgeous kitchen. Okay, I'm sure, like, someone with a kitchen that's worth €30,000, that's all handmade and that's all this, that, and the other, you know, that's gorgeous, but that €30,000 has to be paid back, you know. So, and I suppose that, like, that's again where we're coming from. We were, like, a young couple, you know, starting out in life, you know, taking out a mortgage to pay for all this sort of stuff. And, like, just kind of even one example, you know, like, if you take your average mortgage drawdown in Ireland at the moment is €220,000, and the average mortgage rate is 3%. So if you had that for 30 years, it's costing you €930 a month, for example. But if you drew down €20,000 less by not doing the external insulation, for example, or not doing the thermal panels because, you know, they don't, you know, the finances aren't that sure, for example. But by you know, not drawing down that €20,000, you'll save 4 years off your mortgage. And you'll save, on top of that, not only do you save the €20,000 in principal, you're saving yourself €26,000 in interest. So that's 46 grand that you saved yourself over the next 26 years by not doing that stuff up front, you know? So that was, I suppose that was all kind of in the back of our mind about, like, you know, can we justify spending this sort of money? Like, and it's not that we've forfeited on comfort or style or anything. I mean, like, it's a gorgeous house, you know? Don't get us wrong. We absolutely love it. But I just think that, you know, maybe just think about, you know, all this money has to be paid back with after tax income. So just maybe keep that in the back of your mind, like, you know, is probably what we would say.
Yeah, 100%. And so the kitchen is, what is it, a flat pack kitchen you put together yourself? Or?
No, we didn't put it together. It arrived, all the carcasses were made, all the, you know, it arrived like any kitchen would arrive, all the units were made. And are already assembled, and the kitchen company supplied a kitchen fitter, and he was there for a day or two putting it in. So I suppose with the kitchen, we reused the old kitchen carcasses and doors. We reused them in the utility. I was only looking the other day in the utility. I was kind of looking around and said, "Jesus, this building, this room cost us nothing." We reused the units, we reused the countertop, we reused sink, we reused the floorboards or the laminate floor that was in the old living room. And I was sort of saying, like, that, you know, that's kind of like a free room for us. So because we had that, we didn't need, you know, all that much storage, essential storage in the kitchen. We only just needed, you know, cupboards for bowls and cups and everyday sort of stuff. The utility acts as a kind of a pantry or a backup sort of storage place. And with the kitchen then as well, is, you know, another kind of maybe top tip for us was, like, with the island, for example, we've gone to a lot of, you know, kitchen companies, and they were sort of saying, oh yeah, you need an island, and you need the seats at the island, the kind of raised seats. And like, we never found them, like, I never find them comfortable, because if you're sitting on them and you want to scoot forward, you kind of have to get up off the seat and kind of stand forward and bring the seat. And it's just, they're kind of awkward. And in our case, the dining table is right next to the island anyway, so we weren't going to see ourselves sitting at the island when there's a seat just there behind you, sort of thing. And my experience is that, you know, those island chairs just ended up being coat hooks or coat hangers. So we had an idea in our head of what kind of kitchen island we wanted. We wanted something where, okay, you have countertop where you can, you know, make your sandwich or whatever you're doing, but we wanted a kind of a lip around it to kind of hide it from the living room and from the dining table, because we were conscious that, you know, we've one big room. We don't want to be seeing messy plates and chopping boards and all that sort of stuff. But no one could kind of, you know, that sort of lip that we have on the island, like, doesn't kind of exist in the brochures or anything. They're all trying to sell you this thing of, you know, have one big countertop, be it granite or faux granite or whatever it is, and have your seat on the other side of it. So we just sort of said, no, look, let's just build a stud around it and put on sheet of MDF and paint it up, prime it up and paint it up, and away you go. Now all of a sudden you have a gorgeous looking island that probably cost like £200 max, you know. And, you know, it was all something that, like, if I can do it, any person can sort of do it, you know. So it's just those sort of things, just kind of, you know, kind of think outside the box a little bit, like, you know. And again, try and do as much as you can yourself to, again, cut down on costs, you know, cut down on spending. Like, you know, by all means, bring in your friends and your cousins and you know, seek advice from people. Like, I appreciate, you know, I spoke earlier on there about working out how much, you know, units of electricity and this, that, and the other. I appreciate not everyone's going to get their heads around that. But, you know, people will know engineers and stuff. So maybe just call on advice to help you out in your project, you know. If people are coming to help you out, to actually give you a day's work with plasterboarding or, you know, demo work or whatever, be sure to thank them on the day. Another thing as well is what I would have done anytime anyone came down was, you know, I would have taken a moment during the day, during the work, to kind of just step back for a second and just take a picture of what was going on. Because when you're in the thick of it, you're kind of, the adrenaline's going, you're just, you know, you're doing the work. But it's lovely now, you know, as the years have gone by, to look back in the pictures of, you know, I'm working with my father, for example. My own father came down in his 70s, you know, doing plasterboarding with me and my brother. You know, great memories. My brother-in-law's, Elaine's uncles, Elaine's dad, you know, all these people came down to help out, like, you know. And having those pictures of those moments of us in the thick of it is lovely to have. And then, like, so to kind of close the circle on that, like, you know, once the job was done and once we'd moved in and the dust had settled, you know, we just kind of went online and just made up these thank you cards. But we used the pictures that were taken of them doing the work as, you know, as the card. And, you know, that was really kind of, for us, it was kind of like that personal touch to go back to people and say, listen, look, we really do appreciate those couple of days you gave us because it really got us out of a bind. You know, so I think people, you know, family and friends, people will work with you, you know, and it goes around. Like, I mean, you know, we've brothers and my own brothers and Elaine's brother, they've all gone on and had houses themselves and we've gone and helped them, like, you know. So I think everyone, you know, genuinely in the bottom of their hearts wants to try and help people out, especially when they're friends or family, you know. So so yeah, I don't know, Shaluk, Astrid, I could talk all day about, you know, solar panels and
but
batteries
just tell
and
me
everything.
This. Tell me this. So what would you change if you had a magic wand about the place?
The only thing I would change, Astrid, and this is like, because I have thought about it over the years reading the self-built magazines, and you asked that question of all renovators. The only thing I would change, and I'm not going to change it, but if something happened and I have to, is I might move the gas stove from where it is. So again, if anyone's looking at the magazine, they'll see it's kind of right next to the TV. And where that is actually like, is right next to where the old chimney was. There still is, the chimney is still there. The chimney breast is still there. The original plan was that I was going to vent the balanced flue from that gas stove up through the existing chimney and out through the roof. Now, as it turns out, that chimney was leaking and it was going to be a bit of a bother to try and get the flue up into the chimney breast. So we actually just went straight, you know, we installed the gas stove next to the chimney and we would just put the balanced flue straight up and out. And we have a new cowl on the roof. Now, looking back, I should have maybe re-looked at the model at that stage to say, well, now that the stove doesn't actually need to be there where the chimney is, could we put it somewhere else? And maybe if I had my time back again, I would have put the stove on the other side. Kind of, again, if you're looking at the magazine and you're looking out the window with the armchair, I would have it on the right-hand side. So it's right kind of next to the window. So that way, now the stove is there. You might put the TV there, for example. So now you're kind of angling the chairs, looking at the TV and kind of angling them, looking out the window. That's probably the only thing I would change. You know, so that, like, so what I'm trying to say is that if something changes to your plan, in my case, the whole thing with the chimney, the you know, not going using the old chimney, maybe you should just step back for a second and look at your plan to see, right, now that there's no tie to that location, could we rejig things a bit? Because that only occurred to me kind of afterwards, like once the project was completely done. I was like, oh, maybe I should have put it over there. But like, it doesn't keep me up at night at all. Like, you know, you know.
But you had to say something to that.
I had to say something, exactly. Like, I mean, yeah. every project has some bit of a, not quite a boo-boo, but something, you know, that you might have changed. Like, you know, but like just even another one, for example, and this isn't like, you know, how things can change. Like, I mean, we've done the model. And, you know, as I was doing the stud work around the place, I said, you know what, it'd be very handy actually inside the door is like a cloak room. Just to hang your coats and stuff. And like that wasn't on the original model, but because we were doing all the work ourselves and because it's only a bit of stud work, I was just building this little cubby hole behind the front door for your coats, like, you know, and the thing is absolutely rammed now with coats. And so if we didn't have it, we'd be pretty stuck, you know. So that's the other side of things of doing a renovation. And when you're the person in control and doing the work, you know, you can do those little modifications on the fly, you know. So, you know, I was talking there earlier on about, you know, you were asking about keeping on top of the budget and this, that and the other. And like, you know, just like at that time, I would have been traveling with work, you know, every couple of months to Dublin, to Belfast. And like, for example, like, and this is just a kind of a quick example, like the Velux in our, the sun tunnel in our walk-in wardrobe it turned out to be 150 euros cheaper in Belfast than my local crowd here. The local crowd couldn't match it. So I would have ordered that and picked it up in Belfast when I happened to be there at work anyway. Another example, the Styra stairs, like there's a truss roof in our house, and they're at 2 foot centers. So that meant that, like your normal, kind of Styra drop down stairs is 600 wide, I think, just going from memory. So that was too wide for I couldn't fit it. And because it was a truss roof, I couldn't cut, you know, I couldn't make a cut into the truss. So I had to go and try and find a Styra thing, stairs that was 550 wide. And I found one in Dublin in a DIY place there. So again, you know, and it turned out to be cheaper as well. So just kind of, you know, just do loads of research, get prices, you know, bounce prices off DIY places, and just be thinking ahead. So, I mean, like I would have known, for example, I would have needed that stairs, but I could only get it in Dublin. So, you know, I knew that in the back of my head. So the next time I was going to Dublin, I'd pick it up. I picked up our flooring for the living room in Dublin. Again, that was half the price of what I pay for it down here in Kerry.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a million, Astrid.
That's it for this Self Build Plus podcast episode. Tune in next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And make sure to explore everything Self Build Plus has to offer. The Self Build Plus journey guides you through the process of building and home improving. The Self Build Plus forum allows you to share and learn from other self-builders. While the Self Build Plus videos and our Self Build Plus virtual events are packed with information and advice. With self-build, stop dreaming, start building.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.